Can a survey change the future? Maybe this one can. Cannabis education is inconsistent at best and missing or misleading at worst. How can we make cannabis education better? What if we ask people who use or are thinking about using cannabis a bunch of questions? What if we ask pharmacists who could be teaching people about cannabis a bunch of questions? And then, what if the answers from those questions were used to help pharmacists teach people about cannabis better? Well, this is exactly what pharmacists as cannabis educators, or PACE, are doing. And PACE needs you to fill out a survey. PACE needs as many people as possible to fill out a survey. PACE needs you to fill out a survey on or before May 12th. This is a limited time offer for you to help change the future of cannabis education. To participate, go to promo.reefermed.ca. That's promo, P-R-O-M-O dot reefermed.ca.
Hi everyone, it's Trevor here. So the audio quality on this one is not great. The Adolfo interview was done long before COVID-19, but the wraparounds were done sort of the first time Kirk and I were kicked out of the studio. So we decided to try to record our wraparounds on Zoom. So that's why the audio is not quite as good as it usually is, but don't worry, stick with us with our follow-up episodes. We get better with better equipment and better sound. Thanks, bye.
It's Reefer Madness, the podcast, with Trevor and Kirk.
Okay, Kirk, we're back.
Hey, Trevor, how are you? How's it going?
Good. So, yeah, we, like everybody else, we've been dealing with COVID-19, so... I'm Trevor Schufeld. I'm the pharmacist. Unlike many people in Canada, I've been at work the past couple of weeks because pharmacy is an essential service. So other than being more hectic than usual, my life is not been disrupted that much. Yours is a little different. You've been self-isolating. Tell us about that.
Yeah, my life has been a little disrupted. As you know, my wife and I were planning on taking a gap year this year. We both had planned to start our gap year in March. And well, in March, COVID hit. And what happened is that Michelle took a little break down south in Arizona, went down and visited her sister. Oh, don't touch your face. Went down south to visit her sister. And just as the borders were closing, Michelle came back to Canada 14 days ago. So we've been self-isolating for 14 days. I'm not disciplined enough to live in one house with two different people isolating from each other. The protocols were that she should have had her own bathroom, her own bedroom, her own kitchen. That just wasn't practical for us the way we live. So I self-isolated and took myself away from the clinical setting for a while and from people in general. The good thing is that Michelle and I are still talking and I am now looking to go back to work. I'd hope to take this year off and travel around and find stories for the podcast. But since we aren't allowed to leave the province or really technically to be on the roads, we decided to take a little bit of a break with that. And I'm going to be going back north.
Yeah, that makes me a little nervous, I'll be honest. Like, as a pharmacist, even in my regular day-to-day activities, I don't get within 6 feet of people, you know, very often. It's pretty easy to self-isolate. We have a drive-through, we have deliveries, we have telephones. At the moment, all with certain restrictions, we are physically letting people in the store, but we keep them behind magic rope barriers. Maybe I'm being naive, but I'm not all that concerned about how we are running our business. But you're going to go up north, and the places you go, your nursing station is the ER and is the ICU and is the everything. So you're going to be jumping right into the thick of it.
Well, it's not the thick of it yet. I mean, I do have to prepare for some stuff. Like I said, first of all, psychologically, I had. I basically was on a year's break. So psychologically, I have to motivate myself to go back north. I've got to get my COVID face on. I've been keeping track of what's going up north. My issue is that I've got friends and colleagues up there that have been working and they need a break. So I got to go up and do an extended period of time to help out and just follow protocols and be safe. I mean, it will really depend on which community I'm assigned to. One thing about the communities I go to is they're all very culturally different in the same way, I guess. And First Nations communities all have different ways of doing things. So it all will depend on where I go, what role I have when I get there. And obviously I'll keep in touch with you and we'll see if the internet up there is conducive to Zoom meetings and maybe we can continue having conversations. But essentially, I think there's going to be a break in Reefer Madness. We're trying to find creative ways of making this work, keeping our brand and keeping listeners interested. I've been having some fun with my social isolation contemplations on Facebook and Instagram.
No, those have been good. And I think that segues nicely into, so I pulled an interview out of the vault that I really, really wanted to do right at, when it came out, but things kept going in the way. You were in Ethiopia. Then we had some, frankly, famous people who agreed to be interviewed. And it's not that this wasn't a really good interview. You even said how much you really liked the Adolfo interview.
Yeah.
But we're finally getting him out of the vault, and I think the word we decided to call his, even though this was recorded back in October 2019, so you'll hear some things that seem a little out of place. Well, that's because it was recorded a little while ago. But Adolfo's information is evergreen. It's still pertinent today.
Well, this is one of the reasons I think we kind of kept bumping his interview. I like this interview, and it's a really good time to bring it off the shelf, Trevor. He hits on so many topics. I think we were just talking about before we got online here was that there are essentially three different interviews in this interview. And I think we'll split it up as we go. I really like how the interview, I mean, you got this guy because of what he's currently doing. He's doing some really cool stuff now with his business. But what brought him to his business and what makes him a cannabis expert? I mean, one of the things I find very interesting about us in this project is that we're calling experts to talk to them about cannabis so that we can learn from it. But how does someone become an expert?
I mean, well, like Adolfo, degree-wise, he's a psychology guy. He's got a degree or two in psychology, yet he was running basically a clinical trial on cannabis for opioid addiction. Like, he's one of these, he's got so many interesting things in his back pocket. And I love the opioid addiction thing, but that was almost an aside compared to the rest of his career.
This is what I was saying. There's so many components to this interview. I mean, he talks about his background from, was it Mexico he's from?
Mexico, yeah.
Yeah. As a young man, a young boy raised in Mexico with a cannabis culture, coming to Canada, stumbling into the cannabis culture, and then from there getting into community development work. I love the concepts. I love how this conversation goes into the whole history of Vancouver and how Vancouver's dispensaries of the early aughts, you know, the early 2000s, how they were self-regulating. And then you move into, well, what the hell happened? I mean, Vancouver, the West Coast, there was so far...
BC Bud, right? BC Bud was so far ahead of the curve.
Well, buddy, in the 70s and 80s, BC Buds were winning contests from around the world. But they also had this business, and Dr. Belle-Neves talks about her experience when she was in the West Coast as an academic.
Go back and check out our Dr. Nurse episode, but if Dr. Linda Belle-Neves and Adolfo didn't actually know each other when they were both in BC, they must have crossed paths like in a hallway somewhere, because they both seem to be involved in sort of that early 2000 exciting time in Vancouver and BC, where they were basically... The city of Vancouver was breaking national laws, but nobody seemed to be caring.
Well, it's not that nobody was caring. The industry was self-regulating, right? That's what I found so interesting. Again, this interview, you stumble into all these different rabbit holes that he took you down. This is why I think this is a very good episode to bring out now, because the information is evergreen. It's not going to ever become history in the sense that it's dated. I mean, the man was in Vancouver when the cannabis industry was just starting up, the medicinal cannabis industry was just starting up. He was involved with self-regulating dispensaries in the early part of the 2000s. He then moved into, like you say, the opiate crisis. Again, as I was listening to the interview, I reacquainted myself to it yesterday. I was listening to it yesterday, and I was saying to myself, boy, he's sounding like he's talking about the way I look at beer. And your guest, he gets into that, to the fact that he talks about being able to taste the soil in cannabis that was grown in soil.
Yeah, no, I loved, and we should probably let Adolfo do some of the talking, but yeah, I loved he calls his course like a cannabis sommelier. And I'll pull out just one of my quotes that I really like from him. We'll talk more about it later. But how are you going to be a wine specialist if you don't drink any wine and you don't even know what a Cabernet Sauvignon exists? Yeah. So, you know, that's his current thing, is getting the cultural, if this was wine, the terroir part back into cannabis.
Yeah, this is a good interview, Trevor. It's a shame that we waited so long to get him up, but I really believe it works at this point in time.
Yeah, no, let's listen to Adolfo.
It's Reefer Madness, the podcast.
Hey, so yeah, I'm Adolfo Gonzalez, one of the co-founders of CannaReps. Organization was put together about 3 years ago to up the ante a bit on the level of education and cultural exposure that new members of the industry were receiving. And we've developed what we have called the Cannabis Sommelier Program, which is a program that focuses particularly on the culture behind each of the different genetic pools, the geographical regions related to these genetic pools. And then we've also launched a entrepreneur course, which provides a more in-depth look at specifically dispensary management. In line with that, we'll be launching some grow courses and other similar courses that focus on different subject matter in the industry.
Thank you very much. So, because it's always interesting, it sounds like this is a passion project of yours. How did cannabis start becoming part of your life?
Sure. Yeah, I come from Mexico, and I moved to Canada around 2001. And back home, I was having a lot of difficulty having access to clean medicine. To be honest with you, the primary issue was having access to medicine safely. A lot of my friends were going to jail and even losing their lives for the sake of just obtaining some decent pot. So I applied to UBC with the help of my parents, and I entered the psychology program there. And immediately, as soon as I moved here in the year 2001, it was the same year that Canada had started the MMAR program, so the first federally licensed program. And it was one of the primary reasons why I chose to immigrate to Canada, because I really thought that it would be a fantastic opportunity for me to apply everything I knew from varieties and genetics back home and sort of start to work with people that had a similar passion. And so 2001, I started doing a lot of activism at UBC. And as soon as I arrived there, started what was called the Cannabis Society, which was sort of the preemptive organization to Hemp 101, which was an organization that lasted for quite a while at UBC. We were the first cannabis organization that was really heavily endorsed by the university, and they provided us with some classrooms to do a lot of community discussions and training sessions for people that were, you know, at the time when the federal program came out, people were basically burning their houses down because nobody knew how to set up their lights or even do the basic work, you know. So that's sort of where I started. And I am a medical user. I've been using cannabis primarily for insomnia, but had some accidents in Canada snowboarding. So I started using it also as a sort of a replacement for opiates. And I segued off to do a lot of research with dispensary groups after I finished university. And I started focusing a lot on patient access and how people were obtaining access, and started working with a lot of different types of community members to help them gain access to the right type of variety and help them go through that journey of trying a lot of different stuff to figure out what exactly was working for them with their condition. And so that segued off to doing a lot of R&D work for different licensed entities and dispensary groups. I ran the first opiate substitution program in Canada, a study which we managed to publish in the IACM, which was sort of a pinnacle for my research career. And from that point, I started doing a lot of work that was a lot more sort of advocacy in nature. Like I was one of the lobbyists that helped the city of Vancouver to decide to regulate dispensaries in the city, which was the first regulative system in Canada. So from that point, I basically started doing more and more R&D on product development and working with different types of patient populations. And I developed the first iteration out of that work of Canareps, which was actually primarily focused on therapeutic use. With the change of laws in Canada, dispensary workers clearly had been stipulated to not engage in any type of therapeutic guidance. So at that point, I shut down my therapeutic guidance program and I started to focus entirely on cannabis sommelier and entrepreneur training. So yeah, that's the whole spiel.
Wow. So many things I want to touch on in there. And then, but so first, because it keeps coming up over and over again, tell me a little bit more about the opioid replacement study. What did you guys do and what did you guys find?
Yeah. Well, we started with a gamut of about 30 participants, which were very difficult to sort of get together because you had to have everybody verified from a methadone clinic or from one of the heroin programs that existed in the downtown east side at the time. There was an assisted heroin program that was pure heroin at the time. And so it was primarily folks that were enlisted in those methadone clinics or in those heroin programs. And so we had to have all of the paperwork backing the fact that they were actually utilizing those products. And I mean, that's not easy to find because you need to have a compliant pharmacist, which, you know, to find that is like a needle in a haystack, and they have to have a compliant doctor behind them. And so it's a lot of medical practitioners you need to get together. And 30 people were, I mean, I can't explain to you the amount of work I had to do to find those 30. And out of the 30, only 11 people managed to provide us with, let's say, sufficient data points to derive any assumptions. And so as you can see, this was a sort of initial incursion into the subject matter that it does not utilize a population size that's sufficient size to really make any level of concrete assumptions. So that's the first point I want to make. But we did find some pretty, I mean, I thought, and obviously the IACM accepted us because of the findings. The findings were pretty revealing. So over half of the 11 participants reduce their reliance on methadone, which is just staggering because reducing your reliance on methadone is not easy. You know, it's the lives that these people live and, you know, the impacts not only on their bodies, but on their social lives and on their family lives is just, it's beyond description. It's a very difficult thing people are going through, and to have over half of the participants purely based on the use of standardized cannabis capsules. So we actually, it was the first study that I know of that utilized standardized quantified capsules that were from the same variety throughout the entirety of the study. And they were donated by a grower whose name he preferred not to mention, but it was a fantastic sort of community effort that came together. We had some private donations, and a lot of amazing community work went into sort of getting those people medicine that was either discounted or free, being provided to them out of the dispensary that they were already utilizing to get those specific products. So we were not encouraging people to try something that they wouldn't like to try. We weren't encouraging people to try dosages that they weren't comfortable with. We just let them pick their dosages, use the medicine as they deem fit. And over half of the participants some of these people were seeing an increase of 50% decrease reliance on methadone purely with the standardized cannabis capsules. One of the participants, this is the point that kind of shocked me, one of them managed to completely stop using methadone. And that was, out of 11 people, that was something that really shocked me, because I actually went to his methadone clinic and I inquired directly, and he hadn't been there for weeks. Actually, I stumbled.
Do things like drug screens on them to see whether or not he's on
No. That would have been beyond the sort of ethics parameters of what we were doing. It was a, this was a study that was sort of a, we're trying to figure out if it's worth doing a larger scale double-blind study. That's sort of like the objective that we had. So basically, participants were voluntary and already using cannabis as well as opiates. We didn't do an initial baseline test for who was actually... what we used as the initial baseline test was simply their paperwork from their clinic, which verified that they were actually using opiates to begin with. And the only way that we could actually measure that people were decreasing their use and reliance on methadone was through collaboration with those methadone clinics and discussing with those methadone clinics if what was being reported was actually something that they were observing on their end. So it's, collecting, as soon as you collect blood or tissue samples of any sort, you actually need a different level of ethics committee approval in order to then have your study approved for publication. So there's just a whole sequence of ethics standards that need to be met in order to be able to do those things. And at the time, we didn't have a backing university that would take the program. So we actually ran the program under a private R&D company, which I was working for at the time, which was owned by Dr. Paul Hornby. He's one of the guys that did early phase quantification of the plant in the West Coast. He's also one of the people that was involved in early phase genetic testing for different types of genotypes. So he was a great mentor and great guy to work under. But because we were not a university and we could not have ethics committee approval done as thoroughly as needed, we knew that we could only collect certain data points and actually have it be publishable at the end of the day. And frankly, I was very surprised that we were even accepted to get published because of the nature of where we were obtaining the participants and where the medicine was being supplied out of, which at the time were illicit dispensaries, right? At the time, I'm talking 2011 and 12, 13, I think we published. That was a period where there were no licensed dispensaries in Canada. So all of this work was conducted in the gray sector.
Wow. And just before, because you obviously sound knowledgeable, but just so I have it clear, what degrees did you get from UBC? Like, you obviously know about research now, but did you have some research background before you started doing this?
I worked in a lot of research labs, primarily focusing on psychology. My degree's in psychology. I also have the equivalent of a minor in anthropology, and I actually practiced archaeology for a short period of time. So I was going into the cultural sphere of this, but I actually practiced in Mexico for a while, and I realized it wasn't for me. So at that point, I decided to focus full-time on cannabis.
Fair enough. So, and honestly, we'll get to the present soon, but you have a very interesting past. So you were part of the regulation of... cannabis dispensaries in Vancouver pre-national legalization. What were you doing with the city of Vancouver? How did you convince them that they, you know, putting a business tax on not legal product was a good idea?
Well, you know, I was working at Eden Medicinal Society at the time, and Councillor Jiang, who was the councillor who had this topic placed on his lap, walked into my dispensary one day because he heard about my publication. And he said, I was surprised to hear that somebody in this gray market is actually conducting research and publishing. And so he sat down and I told him, oh, well, I'm also a UBC graduate, because he comes from the School of Medicine of UBC. He's a PhD from there. And I mentioned to him some of the professors I worked under, and he knew all of them. And so we hit it off right away. And he was just very surprised and delighted to find that somebody like myself was working in an illegal dispensary, and that an illegal dispensary had actually put funds into having an R&D department where we did active testing of essentially everything we sold. And basically we were like a self-regulated entity before there was regulation. And there were several dispensaries that were taking a similar path, including the Compassion Club and the Green Cross and other organizations that paid for testing. And so the city was delighted to see this, you know, that people as citizens, as good citizens, we weren't just trying to put whatever on the counter and sell and focus on money. They were happy to see that there was more going on. So because of that, they asked me to do some consultation for them in terms of figuring out how they could approach city council to convince them that we should regulate dispensaries before the federal government decided to do it, for dozens of reasons that I could name, right? And so I reached out to a friend of mine, Jamie Shaw. She was the communications officer at the Compassion Club, an organization which to me was, I mean, it's the most inspirational group of people in this industry by miles. You know, what can I say? They're a group of people that are actually running it like a profit. It's not profit focused. It's a nonprofit organization, and they actually run it like a nonprofit. And I have to say that at that time, so many people were running under the nonprofit banner, and virtually none of them were actually providing services to the community. So for me, the Compassion Club opened this up. You know, they were open in the 90s. My first wife used to work for them, and it's one of the reasons why I actually became so well-versed early in my career, because those people have booklets and they have nights where they train people, and they have a massage place that brings in massage oils that have THC in them. And I was exposed to all of this as a Mexican who has never seen people help each other with this plant this way. And so immediately when the city contacted me to help them, I reached out to the Compassion Club, and Jamie Shaw was the person who stepped up. And between me and her, we basically provided Councillor Jiang with extensive hours of free consultation to give them all of the sort of international. For me, I have a very international background. I travel a lot, and I've been looking at plants and growing plants in many parts of the world for a long time. So I knew exactly what happened in Berkeley. I knew exactly what had happened. Like, I know people that were involved in that movement. And Berkeley was one of the first examples in North America where citizens stood up and said, enough, we need to do this ourselves. We need to do this right. And Jamie Shaw, you know, we really explained to them that organizations like ours were taking a leaf from those people in California, and we were just replicating. And I told them, look how they worked with city council to enact the first set of rules in the entire country, which set a foundation for how the country then could approach this subject in general. You know, and I don't know if you're aware, but we were talking 98 when it comes to Berkeley. They were talking to city council in the late 90s, you know.
No, I had no idea it was that far ago.
So, you know, it's my friend. It's and for me, as a Mexican kid, who I was an activist at the time in Mexico, very focused on native rights. The Zapatistas were doing their thing at that time, and I was very pro, not revolution, but I was very pro native redemption, native recognition, native rights, and when I intermingled with cannabis always, because I was always a cannabis guy. But when I saw what happened in Berkeley in the late 90s, I told my parents right away. I said, Mom, Dad, like, that's what has to happen in Mexico one day. I want to be part of that. And when the time came, you know, I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. I was blessed by the universe. And Councillor Jiang just appeared at my doorstep. And then with the help of the Compassion Club and Jamie Shaw, the council managed to see the light. And they said, you know what? These people are not a bunch of black market assholes trying to squeeze every last penny out of their clients. So a lot of these people are well-meaning community members that are scientifically minded. And they said, because we have these people, and it wasn't just them, but we put together this organization called CAMCD, which was a result of collaboration with some people from UBC. Really, really amazing academics that basically pitched in to create this organization that was dedicated solely to the pre-regulation of dispensaries. So creating all of the rules and regulations. We wrote it. To be honest, they wrote it because I came about a year after the organization started. And those were the documentation that were the most convincing for the city. When they saw that many of us had already put together an organization that represented many different dispensaries and that we had already looked at each other's practices and established a sort of like agreement on what general acceptable practices were. And then we all started to sort of follow them. That's when the city said, okay, so now we have a community of people that care, that have experience, that kind of what they're doing. They've written things down. We can look at that. And they actually wrote CAMCD into the city bylaws as the organization that would ratify and certify dispensaries to be part of the new legislative system. So it was a great, for me, one of the greatest moments of my career and one of the greatest triumphs probably that I'll have in my life. And since then, I quit that dispensary organization and I basically started this. So that's, now we're ending up in the present.
Now we're up to the present. I promise. Yeah. Well, just one more thing from the past, because it just comes up in conversation. So BC was so far ahead of the whole country for the longest time on cannabis, but now I'm not sure if it's how the province is putting things into place, but it is now much easier to find a legal dispensary in Alberta than it is in BC. Quickly, because we really wanted to get to the present, who dropped the ball or how can we fix this?
Well, you know, my friend, there's so many. Your question is quite complex. And we have a thriving black market here, but that's really not the crux of the issue. The issue has been the rollout, my friend. The rollout of the legislation was a catastrophe. There's no other word for it. Okay? They didn't do their math right. They didn't do their numbers right. They assigned the licenses took way too long to assign. In some areas of the country, as in Alberta, we had enormous shortages. So people that did invest the money, that did open, didn't have the cannabis. So BC was very afraid, and they said, "No, we can't have this because it was a big, you know, the press really devoured them. You know, it was a bad moment for that province, and it's a bad moment for our federal system. And I think that BC put the brakes a bit because Alberta had that issue. Plus, because of the fact that we have a more thriving black market, and we have a lot of people that I think the government wants to exclude from the system. I think that it takes a little bit longer to do our security checks here. It probably takes a little bit longer to do a lot of things here because of the complexity of how much money is being moved around and how many existing points of interest there are, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that many of these points of interest are competing. And so it's a very, very complex landscape. The rollout was a catastrophe, my friend. And the primary one to blame are the consultants and think tanks that are around our government. You can't expect our government to be a specialist on every subject. They pay people to tell them what to think, how to do their math, how to do their rollouts. And I firmly believe that whomever ear they had was not really speaking common sense and didn't do a very rigid math-based assessment of how to make this economic success, something that Canadians wouldn't lose a bunch of money on, as it has been in so many other sectors of the cannabis industry. And really, I think that that's been the number one downfall across the board for rollout of all federal and provincial legislature, is that our government does not seem to really consider enough what is it's not just about what's ethical in terms of applicants and who doesn't get approved and it's about the economic viability of what you're proposing. And that's simple math. There's been some math that has not been done right, not just in BC, but in virtually every one of our provinces. And I am going to say Saskatchewan, I believe, is the exception. Saskatchewan, if you read the law, it has multiple points to it. They actually proposed for per capita, I believe they got the number right of dispensaries that they allowed. The processing times were right. They were there in time at the right time. They had a little bit of product shortages, I believe, not as bad. And it's all got to do with math. It's got to do with how you roll out the logistics of your legislature, my friend. And that's not easy to do. So I'm not blaming anyone directly. I'm just saying somebody dropped the ball in the think tank, my friend.
Okay. Thank you very much. So let's get, so we're up to the present now. So Canareps. So we talked about a little bit. I flipped through the website a little. So what should we know about this? So you're training up. If I come to Canareps looking for training, what can I learn? What can you teach me? What sort of different streams do you guys have?
Well, what our program has become, it's become sort of the go-to for all corporate groups, whether they are experienced or inexperienced. When you want to have a united vision that really gives a backbone and a soul to your company in this sector, you need to know what we're teaching. You need to know the real cultural roots of this movement. And I'm not just talking, not really talking about people like me and Jamie Shaw that made laws. I'm talking about the traditional people and the traditional breeders and growers in those communities that brought us cannabis, that brought us Kush, that brought us Haze, that brought us the different gene pools. It's really about realizing that a lot of folks are coming into this thinking that we're starting from square one. And the number one point that my school is trying to teach everyone is that no, there is not square one here. This is one of the oldest plants that we've been using for a long, long time. And for a lot of non-Westernized people, it is a part of their day-to-day life. It is an important part of their culture, of their society, of their economy, of their legacy. And to a large extent, their legacy has been denied by Western thoughts up to this point. We're still in a place where people believe Kush is just a street name. People think that Kush is just a street name somebody made up. They don't realize the Hindu Kush Valley is a place, and that plant looks the way that it looks for specific reasons. And it has the biochemical profile that it has for specific evolutionary reasons. And so we learn to analyze why plants that are elongated ended up looking elongated. Why plants that are short and stocky, why is it more evolutionary beneficial to them to be short and stocky and highly resinous? And we then connect that with, it's very much like wine culture, my friend. Like when wine culture started to get accepted in North America in the mid 60s and 70s, I mean, now there's people with money and with culture in the 1800s that knew how to drink good wine in America. Right? But the mainstreamification of wine culture starts to really creep in during the 50s, 60s, 70s era, okay, post-war era. And if you see how people received wine initially, you know, and how wine company and wine culture, wine marketing developed over time, I really think that you're going to see a lot of parallels. Because right now, there are not a lot of refined consumers that really understand how a plant is supposed to express based on their genealogy. But I have this theory that cannabis is going to be just like wine. And soon, a lot of people are going to know that they prefer Merlot. A lot of people are going to know that they prefer Cabernet Sauvignon. And a lot of people will know that they actually don't like reds at all, that they like whites. The more that the consumer becomes experienced, the more that there is a demand to understand what quality is, how to denote quality, how to understand quality. And that's intimately connected to understanding the genealogy of the plant. So our course provides something very unique and exceptional. We bring plants into the classroom, which is something that universities still don't do. We bring plants that are cured into the classroom, and these plants have been scientifically cataloged by the companies that have provided them to me. So I know that the variety that I'm bringing that is called a South Indian Haze, an original Landrace South Indian Haze, is a South Indian Haze. I'm obtaining it from a particular individual and a source that is verified. And I also bring in an original Hindu Kush, and I'll bring in an original Afghan from lower elevations in the Hindu Kush Valley. And I will show people in the flesh that you can, in fact, look at a plant and based on its morphology, say, hey, if this is a pure land race, this is probably from this type of environment. And secondly, that's the skill we kind of build on, right? The basic understanding of how different genes express, that's what we build on. But then we bring a good Kush, a medium-grade Kush, and a low-end Kush. So you can understand how this genealogy expresses at different quality levels. So basically what I've done is created the first, it's just like sommelier school for wine specialists and wine consultants. Except that what I've done is I've created a system that you don't have to go full throttle in the first one of the course. So that's why a lot of corporate groups sort of, they run the CEO or the CFO, everybody that's at the top, and then they'll run also everyone that's at the mid and the front lines. Because we start at level one, which gives everyone a good starting point, just like, hey, varieties are real. They exist. And they come from different parts of the world. And let's talk about that, right? Because if you're in cannabis, let's say you want to make the best beer in the world, but you don't know what IPA means. You don't even think IPA is a real thing, right? That's right. Going to create an industry where you have a bunch of nonsensical products that don't actually deliver value, a bunch of marketing that's empty, a bunch of stuff that's already happening right now that I'm very much against. A lot of people don't actually believe cannabis can provide therapeutic benefits to people. And although I don't really focus that much on my class, that's a big problem to me. That's a big problem to me when people tell me cannabis is just marketing. I just put it on there for marketing. Cannabis is not really, you know, going to relax people or give people a benefit or something they enjoy, something that adds to their life. And that's really what I really want to strive in at level one to a company is very simple. This product has a history. You must know that history if you want to make the best product, because how are you going to be a wine specialist if you don't drink any wine and you don't even know Cabernet Sauvignon exists? How do you do that? How does one become a wine specialist without knowing anything about the process of wine manufacturing or without caring anything about that, right? So we focus on that. We focus not only on the genealogy, but on the methods of growing and how living organic soil growing tends to accentuate that particular sweet, earthy flavor. But not just that, you can taste the earth in the plant when it's grown in earth, but also it's how those genes become unlocked when they're exposed to the right kind of environmental conditions that really maximize the terpene potential, that really maximize not so much the cannabinoid content, but how that cannabinoid content is expressed in the feeling of consumption when the right amount of total terpene is there and when the terpenes that should be there are there. So the ones that are expected from that particular variety, right? So it's what we're teaching, my friend, is we're trying to add a heart and we're trying to add some culture and we're trying to make people really excited to taste their product. This concept that a lot of my academic counterparts have, which is that tasting has no part in quality assessment. The QA parameters should not include anyone ever burning a joint. How uncouth? Well, let me tell you something. That is exactly why we have so many misunderstandings about the way people use this plant and about how it can be beneficial, how it cannot be beneficial, because a lot of our thought makers do not consume cannabis on the regular. They don't know what's hot, what's not, what people are liking, what people are not liking, why. They don't know that. They don't focus on that. They focus more on receptor binding, on quantifying what's in the plant, et cetera, et cetera. The consumption experience, the je ne sais quoi of the yum, like why something is yummy to one person and not yum to another, which has a lot to do, you might know, with the medical effect obtained. That's what we're trying to dive into. We're trying to say cannabis is not just science. Yes, it is mostly science. Yes, absolutely. Science is the bedrock upon which we build. But there has been an enormous amount of culture and art that have come into the fold that are completely neglected right now. DJ
and
Short
does
not. I want
to get the Collector's Cup in a second before I run out of time with you. But just, all right, so if you know, I was part of a large company, I can see how, you know, signing up for one of these courses would be great. What if I'm just an individual person just getting into cannabis? Is there any sort of courses aimed at, you know, the can of curious, the I've tried it a couple times, I want to learn more? Does your company sort of do the equivalent of a amateur wine tasting for the, you know, the newbie or not so newbie into cannabis?
We do shorter workshops, which are 1 or 2 hours. However, Even the average consumer, the person that's inquisitive on whatever level, the level one course is really designed for all of those people. It's designed for the corporate group. It's designed for the member of the public. It's designed for the doctor, the academic. It's designed for anybody who doesn't come from this culture that I've lived and breathed since I was a little boy, because I had the good fortune of being born in a family where that plant was not a bad thing. So I've been learning about it since very young, and bringing people into that world of breeders, traditional growers, seed companies, bringing them into that world and making them realize that this is an established community, that's something that benefits anyone, because it really opens your eyes. If you're not from this world, it really opens a whole new world to you. So it's good for people in the industry and members of the public, designed for both.
Hey, thank you. All right. Collector's Cup. I think it is just come and gone, your first ever. What was the Collector's Cup? What happened? And are you going to do it again?
Yes, we're definitely going to do it again. It will happen either September or October. We're going to be announcing in the next couple of months. Collector's Cup was the first legal cannabis flower competition that I'm aware of. It was set up to be legal, because instead of asking a bunch of growers to give us flower, which then we would give away to judges, which is clearly a violation of law. Not that I don't support those type of events, but we decided to ask members of the public to simply bring in their favorite flower in a quantity no larger than 28 grams. And this year is the first year that adults are allowed to carry up to 30 grams legally, any adult, right? So we basically created, it's like a wine or coffee show where everybody brings in their favorite bottle per se. And then we look at the product, we taste it together, and we review it together in a non-biased format that provides us with a good understanding of what the hottest products on the market are. And
this has been something, assuming I'm legally allowed to use in Manitoba, I'm not, but this could have been something I grew at home, something I bought from someone, anywhere I could have got it legally.
Exactly. As long as you got it legally, you could have bought it at a dispensary, grown it at home. Somebody could have given it to you as a gift. We don't mind. We just want to look at what are you liking? What are members of the public and specialists liking? We had a lot of growers bring in their own stuff. We had a lot of breeders bring in their new varieties. But we also had a lot of members of the public that were just really hyped on whatever flower. Some of it being LP flower, by the way. So we did have a separate category for licensed producers and for home grow. We didn't pin those up against each other because they don't have to abide by the same type of quality assurance standards. So it was really fun. And we did it all kind of in an antiques roadshow format, where I had some of the most renowned names in the biz sort of sitting at a table. People like Chimera Seeds, Marcus Bubbleman, there was a lot of really amazing people there that basically would just look at the flower being brought in, and then they would provide some background as to the storyline, breeding company, or genetic ancestry of a particular plant. So it was a great opportunity for specialists to interact with specialists, as well as specialists with the members of the public, you know?
And how was it judged? You know, you mentioned taste and what it looked like. Was anybody... Yeah. Smoking it to see what it felt like how are these judged?
Well, we have a standardized grading sheet, which is an app, goes on everyone's phone. It collects all of the results in real time and feeds them into a spreadsheet, which disallows from anybody tampering with results. Everything reported in real time, and there's no time there to tamper with anything. And that's really one of our claims to fame, because most bud cups that exist in the U.S. and in Europe are actually sold to the highest bidder. That's something that has become common industry knowledge. I'm not bursting any bubbles, but we really just collect the grades, and the grades are relative only to physical appearance, trichome coverage, stuff like that, as well as a tasting portion. So people would grade first on physical appearance, then on taste, and out of the two, an average is derived. Obviously, there's many, many factors that go into quantifying the burn, right? It's not just the taste, but resin accumulation, et cetera, et cetera. And when it comes to quantifying it physically, I mean, there's multiple, like I said, it's trichome coverage, the butt integrity, the butt development, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of different parameters we judge on.
And we are rapidly running out of time. I feel like I could talk to you for hours. Thank you, Adolfo. That was fantastic.
Excellent, Trevor. Take care, my friend, okay?
Okay. So, Kirk, my friend.
Yeah.
You know, I honestly, I don't know Adolfo from a hole in the ground. Like I said, it was a couple emails. When we originally got this, we were talking about covering their Collector's Cup, but we weren't going to be able to get it to air fast enough for it to matter. And then, so I don't know him, but oh, I love it when he calls me my friend. You know, I feel now like I'm Adolfo's friend. I'm sure all our listeners now feel like they're Adolfo's friend. He's just a lovely person to listen to.
Well, what I liked about this interview, and it gets back to the whole concept of us and what we're doing with this project, is that we're meeting people who are experts in cannabis. It's easy to become an academic expert in cannabis because, of course, you study it and you get the qualifications that says, hey, I have a doctorate in this, and now I'm studying cannabis and I'm applying recognizable research methodologies. But then there are these people who have no cannabis education, formal education, but they have life experience. And these are the people that I find, I mean, yes, he's got a university degree in psychology.
Well, I was going to say, I think Adolfo kind of falls in the middle. He definitely has some academic and research background. Like, he's definitely got some.
But he's never formally studied cannabis.
But you're right. It's not like he has a PhD in pharmacology.
No. And I mean, but he's got life experience. And my God, did he dump a wealth of that experience into this episode?
Well, and like I said at the beginning, one of my favorite parts was early on when we talked about his cannabis, basically clinical trial on reducing opioid addiction in methadone clinics. Like, yeah. Wow. And because of that, he kind of fell into the Vancouver self-regulation of dispensaries, because one of us, a city councillor, had heard about some of these and kind of stumbled into his shop. And so, you know, now he takes another life turn into regulating dispensaries pre-legalization in Vancouver.
Well, this is what I was saying. This episode bumps into so many of our episodes. Like his experience is touching my face. Don't touch your face. When he bumps into the whole Healing Communities Part 1, our episode, Season 3, Episode 4, when I was in Nanaimo and the safe injection sites. I believe he's probably bumped into other guests. I mean, he talks about the Compassion Clubs, and, you know, we interviewed the Compassion Club again back in Season 3, Episode 4 in Healing Communities, Part 1. So this interview just bumps into so many other parts of our catalog and our library.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things I thought was really interesting is well, again, just the things he's been involved. So, you know, he was inspired by Berkeley City Council meetings in the late 90s. He was, I'm not going to say involved, but in Mexico when there was Native rights and Zapatistas in Mexico. And he's just been everywhere. And the other one that sort of, and as an aside, but I thought an interesting one, when he was talking about basically how BC did not transition as well as they could have into the legal part, he thought Saskatchewan actually did it really well. And they are an interesting, we're probably at some point going to have to interview someone from sort of the legislative branch in Saskatchewan about, you know, they seem to have done legalization maybe better than other places across Canada.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting how he talked about people dropping the ball in BC and going to legalization. I've had many off record without tape, without recording, people talking about what happened in British Columbia. There's lots of theories. Essentially, I think the people of British Columbia like their craft cannabis. And I think they were insulted by the fact that the government wanted to sell legal weed from big businesses when the craft cannabis industry was flying. This goes back to the whole part of what I really am trying to get an episode together where we interview craft growers from across the country and talk about the craft industry. Because I firmly believe it's politics, in the sense that if they want to bust the black market, the gray market, the silver market, whatever you care to call it. They need to bring in craft growers like they have craft beer and craft alcohol.
Oh, absolutely. And if we could, it'd be cool if we could get a craft grower out of like Colorado, because that's one of the things Colorado seems to have done well is they didn't kick out the small growers when they legalized. They made it, I'm not sure, not super easy, but relatively easy for a quote unquote craft grower pre-legalization to become part of the legal market.
It's so critical. This is a whole episode in itself, Trevor. I'm involved with the Canadian Nursing Association. They're putting together a cannabis Con Ed cannabis course, and I'm one of the auditors. I got myself in as an auditor. So I'm editing curriculum. So there's a PhD out there who's creating this curriculum that will be put out for nurses to learn about cannabis, and I got myself on the auditor group, I guess. And no offense to the work she's doing, it's good work, it's good academic work. I recognize what she's doing. I've done this kind of work in my past life, building curriculums, so I understand the concepts. But what's very interesting, what's missing from her curriculum that I emphasized, and I believe I haven't seen the drafts yet, but my incorporation, I've reminded them that this is not new knowledge. If we're going to build a cannabis course for nurses, the first thing nurses have to know is that there's a green culture out there. There is a cannabis culture out there that has been applying this medicine for a long, long time. And when she provided me the first draft of the curriculum, I looked at it and said, where is the green culture? Where is the cannabis culture? Where is the craft growers? Why have you got in here that rosin is in and shatter is only made with harsh chemicals? You can make shatter just through a press. And these are things that the academics may not know.
I think one of the things Adolfo threw in there that maybe I knew and I forgot, but to add to that is how international the green culture is. How, you know, Kush from the Kush Valley, the Hindu Kush Valley, is different than, and from grown in other parts of the world, used for different things by different people, like you said, for literal thousands of years. So it's I'm starting to sound like you, but this is a really old medicine.
It's an old medicine. You know what's really cool about this, and what I really appreciated about what he said is using beer as his metaphor. When you drink an IPA from Britain, the old style IPAs, it's a nice beer. It's a little hoppy. It's got some fresh hop flavor, but it's made with traditional British ingredients. But now, if you have an IPA from Canada or down the road, and they got these hyper hopped, extra hopped, double IPAs, you can see how the old flavor of the IPA is in the beer, but it's this new drink. Cannabis is that way. So he talks about Kush being grown in the Kush region, but the Kush that's being grown in Craft Buddy's basement may have some of the same nuances of that Kush, but I'm sure it's been hyped up and changed. So it's interesting that he uses the beer and even the wine as his metaphor, because when you think about, like I say, 35 years ago, I was bringing beer from British Columbia back to Alberta because I couldn't buy craft beer in Alberta. I may have been breaking the law, I guess, by bringing beer across interprovincial borders. But the beers now I can just buy down the street are so different. So it might be an IPA, but it's certainly not the same IPA I was drinking 35 years ago, you know?
And I think that segues nicely into what he's doing now. So camp reps, this is what they're going to teach people. And he said, especially their level one course, whether, you know, you are a CFO of a LP, or you're just a guy off the street, or you're, say, a pharmacist.
Yeah.
They'll teach you kind of this, the history and cultural background, which honestly was new to me. I've heard little bits of this, but how that might be really important for, you know, if you're a CFO, how that might be really important to what you're producing. If you are a pharmacist, you know, it might actually come into play on what you're going to recommend to a patient. So it's
which goes back to our pharmacy episode. Pharmacists should be involved with the distribution of medicine, cannabis medicine.
Well, absolutely. But yeah, I loved all the different parts of Adolfo's interview. He was a good one. So Kirk, are you going to come up with some music for this time around, or we're going to rely on Renee?
No, music. I got the music already picked, and this is in honor of Adolfo's origins, his history, where he's from. We're going to play Mariachi's Ghost from Winnipeg.
Well, that, and, I like Mariachi Ghost. That's a good choice.
And they're from Winnipeg, and they're connected to Dauphin because they've played at the Watson Arts Center a couple times, and some very good live music. Hopefully we'll get back to live music when this COVID-19 stuff is over.
Kirk, great choice. Thanks, everybody. So if we haven't said it enough yet, come back. We're Reefer Madness, the podcast. Find us at www.reefermed.ca. And keep safe out there, everybody.
Like the show? Let us know. We're Reefer Madness on Instagram and Facebook, at Reefer Madness on Twitter, or head over to the website at reefermed.ca to find out what we're all about and what's coming up next. Susana, tú y el alma.
The beard comes off today.